America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain.
Yeah, but just don't tell Limbaugh he'll want some. Welcome, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, Air America Radio or AirAmerica.com for a blog. Coming up in the second hour of our program, actor and activist Mike Farrell is going to drop by about his journey from delivering groceries as a teenager to Lucille Ball to his firsthand account of the ravages of war. We'll talk about Gonzalez being the fall guy for Bush. And has China proved that capitalism doesn't need democracy to work? And what does that mean for us? We'll be talking about that in the third hour of our program. All China, all the time. Our quote for the day from Franklin Roosevelt, former president of the United States, four-term president of the United States. Taxes, he said, after all, are the dues that we pay for the privileges of membership in an organized society. Speaking of taxes, Alan Reynolds on the line with us. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Cato.org is the website. Hey, Alan, welcome.
Hi.
Great to have you with us.
Thanks.
Your op-ed piece, actually Chris Edwards wrote this op-ed piece for Cato, the director of tax policy, saying, you know, gee, we thought that with the Republicans in office, all would be well, and then we thought maybe even the Democrats all would be well because there's an election coming in 2008, but things aren't well. Taxes may go up. How can we even have a conversation about taxes going up or down? Oh, and I should add, by the way, Alan Reynolds, you're the author of a book called Income and Wealth. How can we even have a conversation about whether taxes should be going up or down when we're spending beyond what we are taxing and therefore we are borrowing from our children and grandchildren in order to maintain our current level of, lifestyle and war and everything else? And so arguably, even if taxes went up, it wouldn't be a tax increase. It would be a reduction in the deferral of taxes that we're dumping on our kids.
Well, look, we're borrowing. We're not necessarily borrowing from children and grandchildren. We're borrowing from people who own government bonds. Sometimes that makes sense. Sometimes it doesn't.
It has to be paid back, though, and our children and grandchildren
have to pay. You have to pay interest. Interest is a true burden on the debt. Interest debt is not very heavy right now, but it's something you have to worry about. Does that mean taxes are always superior to borrowing money? No, that's not true of corporations.
Wait a minute. Am I understanding you, Alan Reynolds, to say that we never have to pay back money we borrow?
No.
We just have to pay interest on it?
No. What I'm saying is that just like it makes sense for me to have a mortgage on my house and for corporations to borrow, it can make sense for government to borrow in hard times or for investments or something like that. Yes, we have a deficit.
No, but wait a minute. If you have a mortgage on your home or if a corporation is borrowing money, they do that to invest typically in critical infrastructure. You wouldn't go out and take out a mortgage on your home and quit your job and live off the money that you got from between the spread between the equity in the home and the mortgage cost.
Yeah, look.
What we're doing.
Yeah, you and I don't disagree about that. The deficit's not good. It's not good to borrow for stupid reasons. We borrow for good or bad reasons. The question is, what are you going to do about it? If you try to fix it with taxes, you got to be careful about that because some taxes do some economic damage. Most taxes do some economic damage. Some do more.
Then how is it that during the period from the 1940s until the 1980s, the greatest economic expansion in the United States and arguably one of the greatest economic expansions in the history of the world, and certainly the industrialization of the United States.
Yeah, I read that in your book. I couldn't understand what you're talking about. I mean, we're talking about 40s
we
and
built,
50s,
we,
and you got one good decade out of those four, and that's the 60s. The other three were lousy. But
well, I'd say in aggregate, we built an industrial infrastructure in this country that was extraordinary and massive. And, you know, it may not have shown up in GDP, but it certainly did show up in a strong and powerful middle class and a powerful industrial, infrastructure, which is being hollowed out now. And the top marginal tax rate at the time was 90%.
Didn't affect very many people, and people avoided it like crazy. But by the way, government revenues back then were about the same as they are now with those high tax rates. Didn't raise much money. 18% of GDP is the norm. That's what it is now. high tax rates produce a lot of clever deviants.
Right. So what we've done now is we've moved the taxes off of back in the 50s, corporations were picking up 30-35% of the total tax load. Now they're picking up around 6-9%.
Because they changed to subchapter S corporations, and now they're taxed as individuals. We lowered the individual tax rate, and some money got shifted over from one.
You've got some of the largest corporations in America paying nothing on taxes, particularly the multinational corporations,
because
they're shifting some of their operations offshore.
Corporations don't pay taxes. That's just silly. Taxes have to be paid by workers, by investors in the corporations, or by customers of the corporation.
How can you say that? A corporation is a separate entity. It is a legal entity that stands alone. If that legal entity is generating income, that legal entity pays taxes.
You really believe that? The building pays the tax. No human being pays the tax.
The corporation. I own a corporation, and that corporation pays taxes.
Does that affect your income?
Ultimately, argument that you're making, Alan, is that corporations, when corporations pay taxes, they pass that along and increase goods and service costs.
No.
I didn't say
that. I said it's either borne by the shareholders or by the customers or by the workers. We're not sure.
Right.
Economists aren't sure. Now,
David Ricardo in 1816 suggested that it would always be borne by the shareholders because the price of a product in the marketplace is a function of the market, not so much the small incremental pieces of the cost of the product. And, in the roughly 200 years since then,
it's borne by capital, and that means all capital, including homeowners. I mean, these are kind of arbitrary assumptions. My question to you is your corporation a C corporation or an S corporation?
I have one of each.
Okay. Well, the S corporation, the distributions are taxed at the individual level. At the C corporation, the retained earnings are taxed to the corporation, and then whatever's left is taxed to the individual.
Yes, I know.
These are kind of arbitrary.
They are both corporations.
The question
Pardon?
Is the tax borne by labor or capital, and we don't really know the answer to that. If it's borne by capital and capital becomes scarce, labor may pay it in the form of lower wages.
Here's the bottom line question for you, Alan.
Yeah.
Shouldn't the citizens of the United States and corporations who do business in the United States, shouldn't we be fully paying for the commons that we're using rather than asking future generations to pay for it?
Should the government never borrow money? The answer is no. No economist would say that's correct. Should the government be borrowing money right now? That's an arguable question. Now, if you're saying...
We're talking $9 trillion in debt.
That's not the debt. You're talking about
David
the
Walker, I know, debt. Says it's $50 trillion.
You're
understand.
You're talking about the deficit, not the debt. The debt is something accumulated over a long period of time, including World War II.
That's the $9 trillion.
Yeah.
That's the debt.
That's not a good measure of the publicly held debt, but I don't want to get into these technicalities with you. Look.
Well, we're talking about taxes, so we're not talking about the publicly held debt.
You want to raise tax rates, assuming that that'll raise the revenue, which is wrong, number one.
And in the past, whenever tax rates have gone up, revenue has gone up.
Not necessarily so. Take the capital gains tax increase in 1986, which was repealed by Bill Clinton because it didn't raise any money. Capital gains, people don't have to pay tax on capital gains. You can put the dividend tax back up. I'll quit
taxes on capital gains right now, 15%.
Yeah, but I mean, you put that back
up. You think that's not real revenue?
I just won't sell as much stock, and you won't get any revenue out of me.
What you see is year-to-year changes. In fact, I played that game back during that time. We sold a business, and we changed the year that we were selling the business in order to avoid capital gains tax.
That's what
people do. So you see these year-to-year changes. But the reality is, over the long term, you raise taxes, you raise revenue.
That's what you hope. Okay, now your question is, you're going to raise tax rates on something I'm doing. I'm not going to respond in a way that makes that not work. Good luck on that, because I'm very clever. Suppose that happens. Suppose you're right. This happens. You get enough money, and lo and behold, the deficit goes to zero. What happens next? Congress will either spend it or they'll pass another tax cut. Hence, we are supposed to be talking today about a proposal from Chuck Schumer that's got all kinds of miscellaneous loopholes he wants to put back in the tax code because they sound good. He's already spending, if you will, by tax cuts that favor certain constituencies, money we don't have.
I understand all that. And, Alan, I don't totally disagree with you on that. We're talking with Alan Reynolds, Senior Fellow at the Cato Institute, and we've only got a half a minute or so. But here's the
There are good and bad ways to pay tax. Efficient and inefficient ways to raise revenue.
I agree, and we disagree on what they may be, but yeah. I agree with you broadly. Cato.org, by the way, the website. But here's the thing is that it seems to me that you're promoting this sense of let's be freeloaders on the society, and I'm it just frankly concerns me.
Well, look, I've had to deal with that issue from since 71 I started writing. It was a conservative issue then. Now it's called a progressive. I don't get it. But
right.
Borrowing is overdone, but not necessarily bad. As I said, there's times to do it. There's times not to do it. That's true of households. That's true of firms. That's true of governments. Borrowing okay. right now is not very large. 1.8% of GDP is not very big.
Alan Reynolds. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, Cato.org, and he's the author of a book, Income and Wealth. Alan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. See ya.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Fallen. That's what the stock market was doing, wasn't it? Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. Air America Radio. New foreclosures surged to record levels as borrowers with tarnished credit history had trouble keeping up with monthly payments. This is from the Associated Press. Here we've got all this economic news happening. At the same time, we've got conservatives out there saying, well, you know, we really shouldn't have to pay all these taxes. We shouldn't have to pay taxes on capital gains or on dividends. We should, you know, corporations shouldn't have to pay taxes. Come on. Don't we have an obligation if we're going to use the commons of this country to pay for it? Isn't that just, I mean, isn't there just a fundamental and simple reality there? The taxes are the price you pay for being part of a civil society. And if you don't like the way those tax dollars are being spent, then you get politically active and try and change it. A, you know, number one. So there's this massive freeloader syndrome going on out there. And B, at the same time that we're seeing the Bush administration and the federal government practicing fiscal irresponsibility at a staggering level, it's borrowing and spending. We are also finding many Americans are doing that as well. Well, gee, if the government does it, I should do it as well, right? They're going out and refinancing their homes to get extra money that they are then living on. Now, if you refinance your home and take that extra money and put it into, for example, improving the home in a way that increases its value, you can argue that that's actually a decent business decision, particularly if you intend to sell the house. But to borrow money on an asset, just like the United States borrowing money. You know, we borrowed money to fight World War II. Well, that makes sense. You know, it's World War II. Or we may borrow money for infrastructure. Let's borrow some money to build the Eisenhower Highway System because over time it's going to generate so much revenue. It's so much economic activity. That money's going to come back to us. But borrowing money to live on, borrowing money, it doesn't make sense. And it's coming back to bite us. Other things in the news as well, by the way, lest they escape our notice here. the story behind the story. There's always a story behind the story. The story behind the story on the Gonzalez thing, in my opinion. And keep your eye on this. There's really two stories behind the story. One, the most obvious story behind the story is Carol Lam and Jerry Lewis. Carol Lam is the U.S. attorney who prosecuted Duke Cunningham. She got fired. Many people think that she got fired because she prosecuted Duke Cunningham. I'm of the opinion that she got fired because she was beginning to investigate Congressman Jerry Lewis of California. And this administration was like, okay, you know, if we couldn't stop her when it came to Cunningham because it was just so obvious and so egregious and the press got out there ahead of it, and, you know, but Jerry Lewis, we're going to protect him. And the bigger story behind the story, and this is one that's going to take some time to come out, and it's going to take some investigative reporting, and frankly, I am doubtful that that investigative reporting will get done, because we don't have many reporters out there who do investigative reporting anymore, is how many of the U.S. attorneys who did not get fired, who were good Republican appointees, have been doing what Karl Rove did want done, which is engaging in frivolous or spurious or fringe prosecutions of Democrats and ignoring crimes of Republicans. How many kept their job out of that 93 federal attorneys? How many of them kept their jobs? Only 8 were fired. How many of them kept their jobs because they were doing what the Bushies wanted done? That, I think, is the bigger question. And here's just a small note to cause the Republican base to shudder. You know, the Republicans, they're all going, yeah, Rudy Giuliani, you know, we don't like him on abortion, and we don't like him on gay rights, but he's electable. We need a Republican for president. Well, back in 2005, Rudy joined this law firm, Bracewell, which is now called Bracewell and Giuliani, and registered to a lobbyist firm. It's a law firm that lobbies right in Washington, D.C., and they have a client who's paying them $5,000 a month to keep track of legislation and, you know, act on their behalf, and paid them $5,000 a month this year, and paid them $5,000 a month last year, and paid them $5,000 a month all the way back to April of 2005, a month after Giuliani joined the firm. Now, we don't know if Giuliani brought in this client or if this client came in because Rudy Giuliani was part of the firm, but a month after he joined the firm, this client signed on, and this client is Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who calls President Bush a madman and a devil. Actually, it's Citgo Petroleum Company, a unit of the state-owned oil company, controlled by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who calls President Bush a madman and a devil. They are paying $5,000 a month to Bracewell and Giuliani to lobby for them, which is fine with me, frankly. I try to buy my gas from Citgo whenever possible. But I don't think it's going to be fine with the Republican base. I have a feeling that there's a collective shudder passing through the Republican ethosphere that, what's this about? Giuliani's campaign released a statement that did not address written questions asking about whether he knew that his firm was doing business with Citgo and whether he considered it appropriate. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Get fooled again. Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 35 minutes past the hour. Breaking news, the Congressional Black Caucus has joined with CNN, apparently, to host the Democratic debate in South Carolina. And Air America's offer is still on the table to host Republican debates in 4 states. No word back from the Republican Party, at least that I've seen. We'll see how that tracks out, but that's kind of cool. And also in the United States Senate, breaking a series of roadblocks. This is from the Center for American Progress blog over at thinkprogress.org. Breaking a series of roadblocks imposed by conservatives, the Senate voted 89-9 just now to begin its first formal debate on the Iraq War since Democrats took control of Congress in January. I would say, frankly, this is the first formal debate on the Iraq War since the war began. And at the same time, the House is voting on the Presidential Records Act amendments of 2007. Let's pry loose some of these documents from current and previous presidents. This going back to the Reagan administration. It was an executive order that Reagan executed, you know, whatever you do with executive orders, and that gave presidents the ability to basically hide stuff that they were doing and keep their records secret until, you know, long after they were dead and nobody cared except, you know, a few curious historians. So, and even then, maybe not find things. So, the sunlight may be coming. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, Air America Radio or AirAmerica.com. Either one will get you to the blog there. Bob in San Diego, California. Hey, Bob, welcome to the Tom Hartmann program.
Good morning, Tom. Tom, here in San Diego, you know, we have it's hard to find out the truth about what's going on because our local media is Copley News, which is a mouthpiece for the Republican Party. And,
when you say it's hard to know what's going on, are you talking about the, Carol Lamb, the fired U.S. attorney situation?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. I think one of the things last year that was so very underreported was that, Brian Bilbray, the Republican congressman who was elected to replace Duke Cunningham, was being investigated also. And they put the kibosh on that real fast. They found a local judge who immediately shut that down. And this is just another example of the way they are manipulating the Carol Lamb. I think that's one of the reasons why they went after her also.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Thanks for the heads up on that, Bob. Perfect sense. And tragically so. I mean, it is so important to have an independent judiciary. And obviously, Karl Rove does, you know, it's like judiciary? Yeah, no, not a chance. Rick in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. I'm reading that the Democrats abandoned limits on the attack on Iran.
There's funding bill for the war in Iraq, or the ongoing occupation of Iraq, actually, is what it is. The Democrats, in my opinion, are just walking into it. I mean, you know, they're just, you've got 71 members of the House Progressive Caucus who have been essentially told, you know, get in line, shut up, you know, get with us because we need to. I mean, I acknowledge Nancy Pelosi has a tough job. It's like herding cats. She has to get, I think, 242 votes or something like that, you know, to get this thing passed through the House. But at the same time, the Blue Dog Democrats, the 40, I think it is 40 or 41 or 42 conservative Democrats are being told to vote your conscience, while the progressive Democrats are being told, be pragmatic. And it just, you know, it grates at me. And there's also a great piece in the New York Times today by Walter Dellinger and Christopher Schroeder in which they point out that this whole idea that the power of the purse and the cut off the funds of the troops is the only power Congress has, they say it's just absolute and utter nonsense. And they lay out, and these guys, by the way, one of them is a professor at the Duke Law School, the other is a lawyer, and both of them have been legal counsel in the Justice Department, okay? And they say, no, the Constitution says that the Congress has the right to make rules for the government and regulation of land and naval forces. They can specify anything they want. This goes all the way back to 1799 was the first time Congress used this kind of power to basically micromanage a war, when we said that the Navy had the power to seize ships going to France but not coming from France. So here you had Congress telling George, 1799, it would have been John Adams, telling him how to conduct a war with, or a pseudo-war with France. And Rehnquist reiterated this in 1970. He said it's both utterly illogical and unsupported by precedent that Congress may not delegate a lesser amount of authority to conduct military operations.
So is that it?
Yeah. I mean, you mean the Iran thing?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the, without a congressional approval, that means that, you know, that to heck with the co-equal branches of government.
Yeah, well, maybe, maybe not. Here's the problem. By attaching the Iran, you can't attack Iran amendment to a piece of legislation that the administration wants, you know, funding for the ongoing occupation of Iraq.
Right.
You increase the probability of it passing, and you increase the stakes, you know, of a veto and of a showdown in the Senate. On the other hand, if, you know, what Pelosi, I think, you know, the position basically that's being taken now is, well, okay, let's just do this. This is a separate issue anyway. Let's just do this as a separate thing, in which case it'll never get, you know, or maybe it will. I don't know. Maybe it will make it through the House and the Senate as a standalone piece of legislation.
It's total capitulation.
Yeah. Well, I am not as concerned, frankly, about stripping the Iran provision out, because I do think that that can stand alone as legislation, and I'm confident it'll be pushed forward, and it'll be interesting to hear what Bernie has to say about it on Friday. But I'm not so concerned about that as I am concerned about the fact that the piece of legislation that they finally came up with, and it looks like it will pass and is going to be pushed down to the House, it basically says you can have war for another year and a half. You can have war right up until the day that George Bush leaves office, and let's try to wrap it up just before the elections. If I was Karl Rove, and I wanted the Democrats to write a piece of legislation that was going to give the maximum probability of a Republican candidate getting elected president in 2008 and Republicans getting elected back to the Senate who were either pro-war or anti-war, I would do exactly what the Democrats are doing right now, which is let's wind down this war in the months leading up to the election, because the Republicans will take credit for it. I guarantee you. The Bush administration will take credit for it. And the pro-war Republicans will say, see, we won. And the anti-war Republicans will say, see, we helped end this thing. And all of them are going to be taking credit for it, and it's going to make it even tougher for the Democrats. And that's frankly what concerns me. Why don't they do it in 6 months? Because we are there. We are an inflammatory force. And it's time, frankly, you know, we should be doing this, in my opinion, in a much, much tighter time scale. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Brian and Tamarack, Washington?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Brian, what's up?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can, yes.
I just wanted to say that howdy doody in the White House has got us in World War III, and that for every terrorist we kill, 1,000 are created.
Well, let's not even use that language. Let's not even use that language. Hang on just a second. We're not, by and large, killing terrorists in Iraq. We are, by and large, killing people who, you know, 5 years ago were bankers and butchers and barbershop proprietors, and right now they are trying to push somebody out of their country who's occupying their country, and when we leave, they will go back to being barbers and bankers and cops and gas station attendants.
Okay, I stand corrected. For every civilian we kill, 1,000 more are coming. It's only a question of time before New York, Los Angeles are nuked by a dirty bomb. And what
God
do you suggest we do about it?
Well, step one is what we have done, which is we've put Democrats in control of the House and Senate. We need to get control of the White House as well, this is Looney Tunes what's going on. And we, you and I, Brian, and all of us, we need to be more proactive in participating in our democracy. We need to be out there and making our voices heard. We need to be speaking out, whether it's showing up at the local Democratic Party function, whether it's calling your members of the House and Senate, your member of the House and your members of the Senate, whether it's participating in groups like Democracy for America or, you know, PACs, of a whole variety, MoveOn.org, whatever it may be. I mean, there's so many venues for participation right now, and there is so much that we could be doing. I think it's really important that we be, you know, just getting out there and be doing it. We can't just sit back and say, oh, it's terrible what's going on. I think I'll wait until the next election and vote for a Democrat. That's just not enough anymore. It really never was enough. I mean, America, you go back and read de Tocqueville's book in 1836, 1838, you know, Democracy in America. And the thing he was so amazed about was that he could walk up to a farmer in his field, and the farmer not only understood the political structure of America and what was going on and what it was all about and why and all that, but was also participating. And that's what we need to bring back, is the concept that, you know, not only is paying taxes the cost of participation in civil society, but participating politically is the cost of participating, of living in a democracy. That we get back to that core concept. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
The days come easy and the moments pass slow, and each road leads you where you want to go. And if you're faced with a choice and you have to choose, I hope you choose the one that means the most to you. And if one door opens to another door closed, I hope you keep on walking till you find the window. If it's cold outside, show the world the warmth of your smile.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 9.5 minutes before the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jordan, driving in Tennessee, you were pulled over for a liberal bumper sticker, Jordan?
Yeah, that's right, Tom.
Tell me about this.
Well, I'm from Tennessee, from the 1st Congressional District, and if you know anything about that, it's not elected a Democrat in over 144 years, so I'm the minority here anyway.
Wow.
Basically what happened is I was on my way to Panama City for spring break, and I was pulled over in a small hick town in Alabama, supposedly for not wearing a seatbelt. But the cop searched my car, and as I was behind my car talking to him, he made the comment about one of my bumper stickers that he said that it's disgraceful to the United States of America and it's disgraceful to the President of the United States, and I should be very ashamed of it.
What was the bumper sticker? It's something you can say on the air.
Yeah, it says, if America doesn't stand for honor and decency, then it's nothing to be proud of. No torture, no exceptions.
Wow. And you got pulled, and you believe you got pulled over for that. That's amazing. Jordan, thanks for the heads up on that. That's an amazing story. But keep on driving. Steve in Sussex, Wisconsin. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Tom. Great show. I'd like to comment on your guest from the Cato Institute. First of all, I completely disagree with him along the lines of what George Soros was talking about in his 1999 book about the crisis of capitalist system, in which he basically said that there's a problem with laissez-faire philosophy, especially in the financial system. But I called mainly because I have a bone to pick with you.
Okay.
I also disagree with you, your criticism of Clinton. I don't think it's fair.
My criticism of Clinton specifically with regard to NAFTA and the WTO, is that what you're talking about?
Exactly, yeah. Because I believe that his trade policies go with his domestic economic policies. And after all, we have 23 million new jobs created. And I don't want to go into the whole rant about it because all of this is...
Steve, you know that the new jobs created numbers are bogus. You know, there are jobs lost, and those are not subtracted from them, number one. Number two, if you're creating $7 and $8 an hour jobs and you're losing $20 and $30 and $40 an hour jobs, is that a good thing? Number three, you've got I forget the percentage now, but it's in the high 20s or low 30s percentage of the American workforce that's working more than one job. So these are not like, you know, new employment opportunities for individuals. These are people having to work harder and harder just to stay where they were.
Tom, I strongly disagree that those were all similar type of jobs we see here in the Bush economy, where they had to revise, they had to call burger making manufacturing. I mean, during the 90s, you had high tech jobs, and the reason for that was because Clinton also put a big emphasis on high tech research and development. And at me, as I was working as a software engineer in the telecom industry, now I work in industrial automation, and every time I have a good idea, I have it because I read trade journals and I watch universities. I read the websites of smart graduate students who are here. And
what does that have to do with NAFTA and GATT?
Because every time I have a great idea that translates into a new job for a tester, for a new support person.
Right, and if some corporation can figure out a way to move that job to China, I mean, if in the third hour we're going to be talking about the, you know, it looks like Intel's building a $1 billion chip factory in China
right
now.
That's exactly my point, Tom, that they shouldn't be able to simply move that job to China. That's
NAFTA and GATT. That's what you're defending. I mean, when Clinton passed NAFTA, you know, what did the automakers do? They started building cars in Mexico.
Yes, but there are a lot of
And shutting down factories in the United States.
There's a lot of laws that just don't, you can't just move a job to China. I mean, you can move jobs to China, you know, you can set it up if you're a really big corporation.
Not only can you do it, Steve, there is a department in the federal government that will actually advise you on how to do it. The Office of Trade, pardon?
In the Bush administration, that is true. In the Clinton administration, it was more like,
That was true just as well in the last years of the Clinton administration. The Clinton philosophy was open up the borders, let's have free trade. I mean, you know, they're not ashamed of it. They're actually, some of them are still quite proud of it. They think it just hasn't worked yet. Just give it a little more time.
I agree with you on one account, though, that the last 2 years of the Clinton administration was not what the Clinton administration started, and what I'm talking about is mostly the first half of the Clinton administration when Joe Stiglitz.
Well, but the first half of the Clinton administration was before NAFTA. NAFTA was 96. Clinton was elected
right.
in 92.
That's right. You're correct.
And we started seeing the effects of NAFTA and GATT. You know, it was passed in 96. We started seeing the effects in 98 and 99 and 2000, and that's when we started losing jobs, and that's what our, you know, a big time, really fast. I mean, it was already going to some extent because Reagan and Bush Sr. had been, you know, all gung-ho for so-called free trade. But NAFTA and GATT really kicked the door open.
I agree with you partly on that, but here there's a different component that I think you're missing. And that is that China is cranking out 1 million engineers and scientists every single year. The United States is at 75,000. There's a huge, when you're criticizing, like, let's say, Bill Clinton about Bill Gates about H-1B visas, that's not entirely fair because there's a reason why Microsoft has to go to China or India. We need more investment in high tech research.
I agree. And Bill Gates made the argument before Congress that we need more investment in high end education. And
yeah.
I agree with that. And I think that was a point that he made that I didn't emphasize enough, and certainly the news media didn't emphasize enough. Steve, it's an interesting conversation. I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. We do have to wrap this segment up, though, and we're going to be moving along here, talking to Mike Farrell in a few minutes, and then, you know, I want to get into all this stuff that's going on with China. There's so many dimensions to this. And our economy. Which direction is our economy going? Where are we going to end up as a nation in a year or two or three or four? 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Mike Farrell's on the line with us, the MASH star and political activist. He has a new book out called Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist. His website, MikeFarrell.org and DeathPenalty.org. Mike Farrell, welcome.
Thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
Great to have you with us. You, in your book, you know, it's really the entire arc of your life, starting with, arguably, delivering groceries to the homes of Jack Benny, Lucille Ball, Jimmy Stewart. How did that influence where you ended up?
Oh, it was really just a job, you know, but it was part of the fantasy. I was raised across the tracks from Beverly Hills and had this secret desire to be an actor, and the idea of dancing around in the kitchens of the and the service entrances of the homes of some of the big stars just kind of fed into that dream.
Yeah, and when you had an opportunity to live that dream, what was your sense of it?
Well, it was really kind of ironic. First of all, I had been through a number of things between that fantasy time and the reality time, so I was disabused of a lot of the ideas that I'd had as a kid, but it was really wonderful to be able to work in the business that had been, you know, such a dream for me, and to be able to work with some of the people that I'd so admired. But it's a, you know, it's a hard scrabble business. It's very competitive. It's tough. It's heartless. All the things that you don't think about when you're fantasizing about a career in show business.
Yeah, it's like what they say about Washington, D.C. If you want a friend, get a dog.
Yeah.
You've been an actor. You were a Marine recruit. You've been through a whole series of things. But you've also spent a fair amount of time in third world countries, in war regions, Cambodia, El Salvador, Somalia, Bosnia, Rwanda, the Gaza Strip. When did you begin the transformation, or the transition, I guess might be a better word, from, you know, guy who's looking for a job or actor to activist? Because that, you know, the arc that is described in the subtitle of your book.
Yeah, it's an incremental process, Tom, as I'm sure you understand. When I was coming up, I learned certain things. I had sort of a shock about realizing when I traveled to this country about the reality of Jim Crow in the American South, and the racism in the military, and the Vietnam War, the Kennedy assassination. So many things just sort of brought me kind of abruptly into an awareness of what was going on in ways that I really hadn't keyed into before. And then when I began to make there were some other personal experiences that I talk about in the book, but then when I began to make some headway as an actor, the fact that I was politically aware and or politically active became a source of interest to the people in the media, and that they kind of fed on each other, so that by the time I got to MASH and there were cameras and microphones pointing at me from every direction, and they wanted to know if I was still willing to talk about things or get involved in things, and I was. So it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where I was contacted by an organization, a refugee aid organization, asked to help with a relatively small thing, but that got me, pulled me further into their ambit, and then working with them, I went to Cambodia. And that was my first real adventure into the area of refugee emergency and seeing the human rights violations. And that was followed with a trip to Central America. And, you know, you sort of go on from there. When somebody realizes you're willing to do that sort of thing, some more people ask, and you have more opportunity.
Yeah, I've had a similar experience in 1980. I think it was, yeah, 80, 81, the year that Idi Amin got thrown out of Uganda. I went with an international relief agency, and we took over the Namala prison farm and created a refugee center. And part of my work for a while was burying people who had starved overnight. You know,
it's
just, you see this stuff, and it substantially modifies you for the rest of your life.
Absolutely.
In frankly, I think, good ways.
I agree. You know, I keep saying there are things I saw in Somalia and Rwanda and Bosnia that will never leave me, and they engrave themselves in your heart in some way. But they also enlarge you. They also make you realize that there are ways in which you can reach out and people will respond. And it makes
and they animate us. They cause us to realize that politics does have consequences.
Absolutely.
Politics run amok. In fact, when I was in Uganda, well, the same thing in Colombia. I mean, the comment that I have heard so often is that there was never a famine in the world. In fact, it was an old Ethiopian priest, actually, who said this to me. He says, I defy you to name a famine that doesn't have a political origin. He says, everybody thinks it's all about the weather. He said, but people are used to being able to move. People are used to adapting to the weather.
Right.
It's almost always the result of a war.
Wow.
Or politics.
Sure.
I'm
sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, some policy decision that generally speaking, the people on the operating end think doesn't have any particular ramifications in the lives of those people. It has just this devastating impact. And
is intended to, as in the case of Darfur, for example, right
sure.
now. I mean, look at this disaster we have going on here. So we're talking with Mike Farrell, the actor and political activist. His book, Call Me Mike, a journey to actor and activist, MikeFarrell.org and deathpenalty.org, the website. Mike, what is the the carry-home message of your book? What, how do you want people who read the book to be changed? What do you want people to do as a consequence? Why did you write the book?
Well, I wrote it because I think it's important for people to get it, that the privileges we have associated with being citizens in this country carry with them responsibilities. And I don't want to be separated out by people to say, oh, well, you're this, you're an activist, you're that, you're a communist, you're a whatever, a Saddam lover. I want to be, that's why I say, just call me Mike. Let's talk, you know, let's argue the issues. If you want to discuss things, I'm happy to discuss them with you. If you want to debate them, I'm happy to debate them. But recognize that as a citizen of the United States, you have a profoundly important impact on the lives of people all over the world, and that impact can be positive or it can be negative. But whatever it is, it's an impact you're having, so take responsibility for it.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And well said. An excellent new book, Mike Farrell, Just Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist, and MikeFarrell.com, DeathPenalty.org. Mike, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. And can I just quickly say I'm really thrilled that you're on Air America. I think you're a real addition to the dialogue in this country, and I appreciate what you have to say.
Well, thank you. I'm a fan of your work, too. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Okay.
Good talking to you.
Bye.
13 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And state GOP chairman with close Rove ties. I mean, this is getting even weirder and weirder. Back to the I want to, for a moment here, get back to what's going on with Karl Rove and the U.S. attorneys. The Seattle Times, again, this is from thinkprogress.org. The Seattle Times reports tonight that a chairman of the Washington State Republican Party with ties to Karl Rove pressured U.S. Attorney John McKay. We were talking earlier in the last hour about Carol Lamb. Now it's John McKay to launch a criminal probe. So this gets back to the point that I made, that there are two stories behind the story here with regard to this whole, they haven't put a gate on the end of it yet, have they? this whole attorney gate situation, these U.S. attorneys. And one is, you know, what about the investigations that got stopped? The investigation of for example, Jerry Lewis. The example of the possible, you know, one of our callers said from San Diego that there was an investigation of Brian Dulray. What about the investigations that got stopped? And perhaps even more important, those attorneys who lost their jobs, but perhaps even more important, what about the attorneys who kept their jobs? What about the ones who did what Karl Rove asked? And that's one of the areas where, you know, I have the greatest concern, frankly. The Seattle Times reports, this was yesterday, that a chairman of the Washington State Republican Party with ties to Karl Rove pressured U.S. Attorney John McKay to launch a criminal probe during the hotly contested 2004 governor's race, which had been certified in favor of the Democratic candidate. And this, you know, from the article in the New York Times, Vance said then U.S. Attorney John McKay made it clear he would not discuss whether his office was investigating allegations of voter fraud. He cut McKay off. He said McKay then cut off the conversation. Vance says, I thought it was part of my job to be a conduit. He now operates a consulting business. So this is the chairman of the state Republican Party in Washington State, saying that he said we had a Republican Secretary of State, a Republican prosecutor in King County, a Republican U.S. attorney, and no one was doing anything. The U.S. attorney, a Republican? Well, yeah, it's an appointed position, but does that mean that he should be doing partisan work? This may be a huge revelation. That this guy, you know, Mr. Vance saying that he thought part of his job was to be a conduit. What, from the White House to the U.S. attorney's office? 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
And welcome back. Truth in Broadcasting for a Change in America. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This whole Gonzalez-gate thing, this is Alberto Gonzalez twisting in the wind. There's a series of problems that this presents George Bush. First of all, you've got some Republicans who are saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't be supporting this guy. Maybe we should back away from him. This is from the New York Times. Gonzalez's appearance, this, you know, yesterday, presumably they're talking about his press conference yesterday, which I want to give you a little bit of information about in just a second, underscored what two Republicans close to the Bush administration described as a growing rift between the White House and the Attorney General. Now, when Republicans are telling the press off the record that the Attorney General is separated, or there's a growing gap or rift between him and the White House, which is a euphemism for Bush, then you know that this guy's about to get cut loose. Or they are trying to put it out to Bush that they'd like to see him get cut loose. But the problem that Bush faces is not just that Gonzalez knows where the bodies are buried. The odds are, just like with Scooter, he can tell Alberto, hey, you know, just wait another 16, 18 months. Actually, it's 677 days, 11 hours, 33 minutes, and 17 seconds. You just wait that much longer until I'm out of office. The day before I leave office, it'll actually be 676 days. I will sign a pardon, and you'll be free and clear. Don't worry about it. So I don't think the Bush has so much to worry about with regard to Gonzalez knowing where the bodies are buried, you know, all the things that he's done. But how is he going to find somebody who will come in and do what Gonzalez has done? Where is he going to find somebody who's going to back up Gonzalez's endorsement of torture? Where is he going to find somebody who's going to back up Gonzalez's assertion that there's no habeas corpus right to American citizens, that we the people... You know, I mean, read the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution. All powers not taken by the government revert back to the people. That we, the people, don't hold the right of habeas corpus. Or read the Constitution itself, that the right of the privilege of habeas corpus, and a privilege is actually higher than a right. It shall not be taken except during times of insurrection or attack, invasion. I mean, where is he going to find somebody who is willing to take these positions that Gonzalez has taken that are so patently wrong? Number one, big challenge. And number two, if he does find somebody who tries to do that, at this point, I mean, it's all starting to come out. They're going to get taken apart, too. So if he actually appoints somebody as attorney general who actually behaves like an attorney general and actually has the Justice Department investigate crimes, one of those crimes might be, for example, the violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act by George Bush, or the outing of a CIA officer by Karl Rove, just the list goes on and on and on. So there's that. And then you've got Gonzalez yesterday, and this, you know, he really didn't help his case yesterday. He does 9 minutes. Dana Milbank writing about this over the Washington Post. He says he faced the cameras for 9 minutes and contradicted himself 4 times. Quoting Milbank, "Mistakes were made," he said. This is, you know, he's quoting Gonzalez. "Mistakes were made," he said, in fluent Scandalese, "but I think it was the right decision." Oh, wait a minute. Was it the right decision or were mistakes made? He goes on to say, Gonzalez, this is, again, Dana Milbank quoting Gonzalez, "I am responsible for what happens in the Department of Justice," he posited, "but I was not involved in any discussions about what was going on." Oh, okay. Are you responsible or are you not? He says, "Kyle Sampson's resigned." Okay, he's gone? No, he's still on the payroll. He's still at the department. Then he hasn't resigned. Well, and finally he says, "I believe in the independence of our U.S. attorneys." Right, we should have U.S. attorneys who are independent. We should have an independent judiciary. Gonzalez says he believes in that. But he then... You know, a sentence later, he says all political appointees can be removed for any reason. So he doesn't believe in the independence of them. And then you got poor Arlen Specter. Here's the guy who is taking the hit for slipping into the Patriot Act, the provision that allowed the Bush administration to do this. And he claims that he didn't even himself know that he put it into the Patriot Act. Well, how did that happen? Turns out that there was a guy named Michael O'Neill, who used to be a clerk for Clarence Thomas, who did this little bit of dirty work, according to news reports. Inspector's name, he worked for Arlen Specter, and Arlen Specter had basically hired him because the White House was pressuring him to hire a right-wing, you know, right-hand man to prove that he was loyal to the White House. So he hires this guy, Michael O'Neill, and Michael O'Neill slips this thing into the Patriot Act over Arlen Specter's signature, and Arlen Specter doesn't even know it happened. Or at least that's the story that Arlen Specter seems to be trying to tell us. Very bizarre. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman back with your calls right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Like me and you, I have a silly notion, if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal,
he's a liberal,
I'm a liberal,
unforgivable,
I'm a liberal,
he's a liberal,
I'm a liberal,
he's your typical liberal.
Welcome back. You're right in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy, or maybe it's the vast liberal conspiracy. I don't know. It's all of the above here. It's are we the mainstream? Are we the left? I think we're right smack dab in the middle of where America is. I really do. In any case, but there is a fringe out there, and in fact, let's take a quick look at it. Twilight Zone alert here. The 2008 presidential bid, this from The Chronicle, by Hunter Kloss and Allison Riggio. The 2008 presidential bid just got a little more challenging for the race's only satanic vampire candidate. No, this is a real story. Jonathan the Impaler Sharkey, a 42-year-old New Jersey man who is running under the Vampire Witches and Pagan Party, is currently being investigated by the Secret Service for potential threats toward President George W. Bush. According to Sharkey, Secret Service agents visited him and his 19-year-old wife, Spree, in Ohio on February 15. The visit concerned Sharkey's repeated remarks about impaling Bush, an act Sharkey said he would only do if he were elected president. "They never even asked to see my impaling stick," Sharkey said. Under U.S. law, threatening the president is a felony that carries a 5-year prison sentence. So they go out and question this guy, and he says, they were telling me when they were interrogating me that their job was to protect Bush even after he's out of office. And so I'm looking at them like, oh, you're going to defy me when I become president? This guy, when he becomes president, he can impale. Oh, man. While Sharkey's declarations of his desire to impale Bush may not seem totally feasible, the Secret Service is required to investigate potential threats. Oftentimes we receive criticism as to, you know, et cetera. Yeah, it's an interesting story. It's little strange. Just a little strange. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Jesse in Vandalia, Ohio. Hey, Jesse, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I've been a Democrat. I mean, I'm only 19 years old. I'm about to be 20 next week, but I've been voting since I've been able to vote. I've always voted Democrat, and you know, my parents, they brought me up to be a Republican, you know, but they're just, you know, they're church people, and you know, they don't really listen. Didn't really get Seinfeld, but the question I had for you was, you know, when I first heard Hillary was going to be president, you know, I thought, okay, this would be interesting. You know, I like Hillary Clinton. I think she's a good woman. But the thing the question I have for you is, I mean, what do you think about her? Like, I mean, she's come out now for being against, like, flag burning and easy access abortion and all this stuff. And, I mean, I'd rather vote for her. I'd rather vote for her than Rudy Giuliani. But if he's just going to lie just to try and swing a couple of voters, I mean, what? I don't understand that, you know? I mean, she believes in certain things, you know? I mean, stick to what you believe in. I mean, she's doing the same thing McCain's doing, you know, for a long time. You know, he was against Jerry Falwell.
Yeah, I don't think that Hillary's doing what McCain was. I mean, you know, her flag-burning thing, I my guess is that it was a little bit of gratuitous pandering, but I don't think that what she is doing has elevated itself to the level of John McCain's rather pathetic pandering. But your point, Jesse, that there are areas, and probably a number of them, and some of them very large, where I disagree with Hillary Clinton on policy is, you know, is true and is well taken. But here's the my take on this, my riff on this, as it were. And in fact, I'm going to, you know, thank you for the call. I'm just going to go off on it here. And that is that it's not about the candidate. I think this is the biggest mistake that we make here in America, is thinking that we have to find the perfect candidate. Now, you know, personally, I think of the main Democratic contenders who are out there running, which basically boils down to, so far, the three who have the highest ratings and credibility in the polls and all that kind of thing are John Edwards, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama. You know, my preference would be John Edwards. But I don't think that he's the perfect candidate. My point is that there's not ever going to be a perfect candidate, and it's not even what we should be looking for, because that assumes that somehow we elect leaders in the United States and that we're looking for those leadership skills. And see, that's a variation on the belief that we elect kings, which is what Alexander Hamilton really thought. You know, that's the old conservative notion. Alexander Hamilton in the Constitutional Convention in 1787 said president should be elected for life. There should be leaders. But the framers of the Constitution said, no, we don't elect leaders. We elect representatives. And so if, for example, you know, Congressman Brian Baird in Washington, in Vancouver, he's a regular on my morning program on KPOJ, and he and I disagree on a number of issues, but he comes on the program regularly, and his position is, the people in my district want me to be voting this way, and I am voting that way. And that's something I cannot challenge. You know, when he says, hey, I had to vote this way on this timber thing, and I'm saying, but it's old growth lumber or whatever. He's like, but the people in my district want it, and my job is to represent them. And I have to say, you're absolutely right. You are absolutely right. And so the bottom line here is that it's not about the candidate. It's about the parade. It's about we the people. And so rather than, you know, while I will, I send a little bit of money to John Edwards' candidate's campaign, and I will say on the air, you know, with some regularity, I think he's a great guy and I'd vote for him in a heartbeat. But here's the bottom line. If Hillary Clinton is the nominee, and I sat with Terry McAuliffe sitting 3 feet away from me in this very studio and said the same thing on the air, and he's in charge of her campaign, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee for the Democratic Party, I will vote for her and I will work for her in the hope that enough of us can get out there and get active and participate, that a parade will form that she will want to get out in front of. I mean, look at the progressive movement in the United States. Look at the progressives who've gotten elected. You know, look at John Tester. Look at Brian Schweitzer in Montana. I mean, here's arguably one of the most progressive politicians in America, representing one of the most red states. How did that happen? Because there's a parade there, because he was, you have progressive folks saying, you know, yes, we like these values. I am of the opinion that it's about us. It's about enough of us getting active. If you look back at Teddy Roosevelt was elected as vice president to McKinley back in the 1896, I think it was, or 1898, whatever the election was. And I think it must have been 96, as the rich white guy who was going to represent corporate America. I mean, that was certainly what the McKinley administration was all about. But the parade was building from the 1880s forward with the rise of the Grange movement and the Wobblies and the populists and the progressives. And, you know, by the time the, you know, it reached a critical mass when Teddy Roosevelt became president after McKinley was assassinated, and boom, suddenly Teddy Roosevelt's a progressive. Same thing with Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 1932. You had Herbert Hoover saying prosperity's just around the corner. That was his campaign slogan. And people weren't quite buying that. But you had Franklin Roosevelt running on a very conservative, cautious, I use the word conservative wrong, a very cautious, you know, arguably kind of a Hillary Clinton position, just kind of down the middle of the road, you know, we're not going to make any huge changes. And, you know, Taft-Hartley or Smoot-Hawley had just been passed, rather, by the Republicans, actually, with the support of Herbert Hoover. In 1930, as I recall, 30 or 31 was when Smoot-Hawley was passed this highly protectionist legislation. And Franklin Roosevelt's position was, yeah, let's not do anything really radical. And he gets into office and he does incredibly radical things. Why? Because the people demanded it. Because there was such an enormous parade. And by 4 years later, I mean, that was in 1932. Then you go to, you know, 4 years later and or even a year later. And you got Franklin Roosevelt speaking out in very forceful ways.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And he was talking about economics. This was not World War II. This is the Great Depression that he was talking about. And so my take is that it almost doesn't matter. Certainly it does matter, and it's important for us to, you know, work for the candidates that we want. But if enough of us get involved, it almost doesn't matter, because in America, our political system here in the United States of America is designed that we the people, the first three words of the Constitution, the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution, that we the people are the ones who hold the power. We the people are the ones who make the decisions. And if enough of us get active, if enough of us join the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, the Green Party, the Progressive Party, the Libertarian Party, you know, whatever it may be, get out there and get active. If enough of us show up at Democracy for America meetings or meetups or MoveOn.org meetings, if enough of us participate in the conversation circles, if enough of us get out there and get active and engage in the political process beyond just voting, then if somebody is elected who we don't agree with on all issues, we can push her or him in the directions that we want them to move. And that's, you know, it is so important that we just hold that as our this is where we plant our flag, is that we do not elect leaders in the United States. We elect representatives. And the only way they're going to know how to represent us is if we tell them. So get involved. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Zone. You won't get hauled away if you've got a No Blood for Oil bumper sticker on your car. Nobody's going to ask for an RNC certification or a White House press pass. Although, speaking of White House press passes, Victoria Jones has one, and she's on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
I do. Well, hey, Tom, I'm not actually using it today, though, because I'm at the National Convention of the International Association of Firefighters. And believe me, this is the place to be, because in the press room were a number of my colleagues from the White House Press Corps. We're there, of course, because the president's not in town. But what happens at this thing is that all the presidential candidates, or at least 12 of them, come and speak. So back to back, every half hour, we've had a presidential candidate all day today. So basically, you name them, and I can tell you if they've spoken. I can tell you what they said. It's been fascinating.
Did Giuliani show up?
Giuliani is not on the list.
Yeah, see, he's, you know, because, and you know why?
Tell me.
Well, because the firefighters in New York are hugely angry with him. You know, he and the Bush administration lied to them about the dangers on the 9/11, you know, Ground Zero site. And you got a whole bunch, and then, you know, they worked to deny some of them disability and, you know, basically fought with the union. Funding everything from, you know, high-tech communication to, but mostly medical care. I mean, the firefighters union in New York City, it's my understanding, is absolutely furious with him. And so he's staying away from firefighters as far as he can. That and the news today that his lobbying firm has as a client and has for the last 2.5 years, Hugo Chavez, that can't help him with the Republican base either.
No, I don't know. That's not going to help him too much. The person so far who's received the biggest rock star welcome, Obama got a pretty good welcome, but Hillary Clinton received an extraordinary welcome, I must say. She is clearly their candidate.
Well, the Clinton family, I mean, her husband and she is a senator, but her husband for years before that, they were both good friends of labor, of organized labor, and have been for a long time, so that would make sense.
Would make perfect sense. Definitely.
I assume John Edwards was also well received. I was just talking about him a few minutes ago.
He spoke earlier this morning. I missed him because I got stuck in traffic. I was only able to catch him as he signed autographs. But something I must say, Tom, that's of tremendous importance to me and of absolutely none to you. He is not pretty close up. He is rugged. And it's very unfair for people to make remarks about him that imply that he's a pretty boy. He's not. He's a rugged man.
Yeah, it's sort of like who's the actor who's out of Colorado who runs the Sundance Film Festivals? Robert Redford.
Robert Redford, yes.
Yeah, he reminds me of Redford in that regard. Definitely. And I think the whole pretty boy thing is, you know, it's the politics of personal destruction. It's an attempt, you know, Limbaugh calling him the Brett girl. It's an attempt to destroy somebody personally because you can't argue with their politics.
Well, and it tells me that this is a candidate who they actually are afraid of. Because
yes,
they're not even trying to go after his politics. They don't even know where to go with him.
Right, right. And because his politics are right smack in the dab in the middle of where most of America is. You know, people want job security. People want environmental protections. People want us to get out of the war in Iraq. I mean, John Edwards is right smack dab in the middle of the vast majority of good issues, in my opinion. On the Republican side, you know, how is it shaking out? What candidates showed up and how?
Well, we've had Governor Jim Gilmore, who actually spoke very well and obviously spoke from the point of view of the Pentagon 9/11, made his case. We had Senator John McCain this afternoon, who opened up with a series of jokes, which were not bad. They were not brilliant jokes. Chris Dodd's jokes were better, but they were not bad. Made the case for war and spoke from a military point of view. But really, I don't think convinced anybody of a reason why he should be president, to be honest with you. We've got Senator Sam Brown back later on this afternoon, and that will be really fascinating because exactly what he's got to say to this crowd, I really don't know. But the majority of the people speaking today are Democrats.
Yeah, and none of the Republicans got booed or anything like that.
Everyone gets an extremely warm and fair welcome from the president of the IAFF. And then they get polite applause.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's legitimate to say thank you for showing up here.
I think if you show up and speak at somebody's gig, you should get applause.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I have conservatives on the program, and I say, you know, thank you for being here. I try to be decent to them. I think it's kind of, you know, a variation of the same thing. Any news? Let's just shift for a moment to Washington, D.C. news. You're with the
Oh, yeah.
What's coming out of Washington? What have I missed in the last half hour here?
Well, I don't think you've actually missed anything that's trickled out, although, you know, who knows what emails could have been leaked or could have been let go or might even have escaped in some way out of the White House or out of the Justice Department in the last half hour. As far as we know, the status is exactly as it was this morning. Nobody else has resigned. Nobody else has been fired. Nothing else has moved forward except that, as you know, we're pretty much have already been told that Karl Rove isn't going to testify, so we're going to be getting ready for a battle royal.
Karl Rove is invoking executive privilege?
No, we haven't been told that, but we were pretty much told yesterday by both Dan Bartlett, who indicated that staffers normally do not testify, and Tony Snow, who said something else along those lines, but indicated that Karl Rove will not testify.
Before
Congress, but they would try to find some other way of getting the information to us.
Wow. I recall staffers testifying. In fact, it's fairly routine for White House staffers to testify, isn't it?
I thought so. Well, they testified before the 9/11 Commission, as I remember.
Right, although that arguably wasn't Congress. I mean, that was a commission rather than a congressional.
That's true.
Committee or something like that. But I'm thinking of some of the Clinton investigations. It seems like some of his staff people, and certainly during Watergate, John Dean testified before Congress, and he was the counsel to the president. I mean, you can't get much more of a staffer than that, I guess.
That's a good point.
So he was also the guy who let the cat out of the bag. That's probably why they don't want Karl Rove to testify.
Right, I don't think Karl Rove is doing that with any cats.
There you go. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Welcome back. Three major stories in today's Wall Street Journal that point to something real critical here for all of us. These three major stories about China. The first one's headlined, China's Inland Frontier Beckons. Big, lesser-known cities hold growth prospects for foreign firms. And it's all about how companies are now moving into deeper and deeper into China. Big American companies or multinational companies. They note, for example, average salaries are at least 30% lower than those on the coast, IBM says. Inland cities can be rich pickings for companies that learn how to tap them. So there's that article. And then there's another article about where the headline is Beijing clears Intel chip plant, marking a potential milestone. $2.5 billion semiconductor factory being built in China. Intel hasn't confirmed or denied it, but China's saying, yep, sure enough, it's going to be built in Dalian, a northeast port city in China. And then another major story in the Wall Street Journal today, property owners feel right at home in China. And they note, and this is, I'm quoting from the story by Shai Oster, China's rates of home ownership are as high as 80% in the cities, according to some estimates, topping U.S. home ownership rates of 69%. More Chinese own their homes than Americans as a percentage? When there's a billion Chinese and there's only 300 million Americans? I mean, that's mind-boggling. So that's what we do know. Then there's what we don't know.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind. Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be, by the way, our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment sponsored by theliberalstore.com with a THE, all things liberal and bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Check out the liberal teddy bear there now. That's theliberalstore.com. James Mann is with us. He's the author of a new book, The China Fantasy, How Our Leaders Explain Away Chinese Repression. James, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. Here we have all these articles in today's. This is just, you know, a random four example It's just a, I mean, you've been booked on this program for a while, and it's just a total coincidence that three major stories about China in today's Wall Street Journal. Or, in a way, maybe it's not a coincidence, because China is one of the big economic stories of the day. And yet, none of these stories point out that China may not be the very best partner for us in the world. At least in your opinion.
In fact, what they leave out is the political side of things, which is there is sort of a conceit, an American conceit, that all of this trade and investment is changing China's political system, that China is gradually becoming more democratic, and it's not. In fact, you could argue that the trade and investment are reinforcing the existing system, but there's no sign that political repression in China is coming to an end.
Is it true that China imprisons people routinely for expressing political points of view?
Well, in fact, right now, there's a story on the web today, I think it's probably going to be in tomorrow's New York Times, that as China's legislature holds its annual meeting, this is the formal legislature, which is in fact controlled by the ruling party, that while this is going on, China has been carrying out an extensive crackdown in rural areas and in southern China to make sure that there is no dissent.
And that those people who are imprisoned for political purposes are subject in many cases to torture, to execution, and in some cases to execution so that their organs can be sold?
Well, that's the latter one, whether people's organs can be sold. That story really hasn't been documented, but the rest, for sure, yes.
Okay. And, you know, there's this conceit that you talk about. I think this is the big thing. We have, and I track this, frankly, back to Ayn Rand, you know, coming to the United States from the Soviet Union. And she saw her father lose his business in during the Bolshevik Revolution in 19, whatever it was, 18 or 16 or whatever the year was. And then she went to the University of Kiev, and then she moved to the United States, and she had this idea, and she founded Objectivism, out of which grew libertarianism, and out of which grew Grover Norquist variety conservative politics, and out of which comes, to some extent, the modern Republican Party, at least philosophically. And she had this notion that there were these two political systems, communism and capitalism. And, in fact, capitalism is not a political system. It's an economic system. And what China is demonstrating is that capitalism can coexist very well, thank you very much, with dictatorship.
Exactly. China is showing now it's really a different model. It's different from the Soviet Union because it's proving it's both blending capitalism with a Leninist political structure and also showing that it can prosper in part by keeping wages low and producing a system which is open to Western investment and yet in no way open to political liberalization.
It seems that we're talking with James Mann, the author of The China Fantasy, How Our Leaders Explain Away Chinese Repression. It seems like this is almost something entirely new. You know, this isn't the old Mussolini-style fascism where you do away with parliament and replace it with the representatives of the major corporations in the country and let them, you know, where you literally merge corporate and business and government interests. And it's not communism. It's not the classic communist state where the state controls the means of production and distribution. There is free enterprise and there is capitalism. There's even a stock exchange. And yet, you know, it seems like this is a very new thing. And yet, if you look at European kingdoms back 600, 700, 800 years ago, many of them violent and repressive, capitalism was flourishing at that time in them as well. Isn't this in some ways just a reinvention of the old kind of kingdom system?
It's a combination of that, and really it's a kind of crony capitalism. There really is no real name yet for the system that China is evolving, but other countries are really looking towards this and just seeing whether it will work. It's become an alternative to the classic Western model.
To democracy and capitalism, or democracy and regulated capitalism, as you find in most European, Western European, and certainly the Northern European countries.
Exactly.
How, the subtitle of your book, James Mann, the title is The China Fantasy, the subtitle, How Our Leaders Explain Away Chinese Repression. How are our leaders, explaining away Chinese repression?
You know, I look in the book, I try to go back about 30 years, and a succession of American presidents of both parties have come up with a series of arguments that deflect attention away from repression.
This is going all the way back to Nixon opening to China in, what, 72, was it?
Right. You get to the late 70s, there's a democracy wall campaign in China, and the argument is made, this is during the Carter years, that I call it the Cultural Revolution argument. Things might be, China might be repressive, but at least things are better than the Cultural Revolution. And that was true, but that argument still persists after 20 or 30 years. So that was one. The second is to confuse economic change with political change. The first time we saw that was under Ronald Reagan, who visited China and was set on the way back this so-called communist system, which was a way of saying we're going to focus on economic change and not political change.
Then arguably, yes. Not that I like to defend Ronald Reagan, but if communism is defined in the classic sense, you know, Karl Marx's the state controls the means of supply and distribution, China is not a classic communist state any longer.
No, it's not. It's still a Leninist political system, but it's
right,
not. In economic terms, it's not.
Right.
Then you get in the 90s the biggest rationalization, which is that trade and Western investment aren't going to lead to democracy. That really begins in the late in the early 90s, and that's
being sold to us in the Middle East as well.
Yes.
You know, we should just do more business with Saudi Arabia, even though it's a repressive dictatorship. Dubai, we should liberate Kuwait and put the emir back in charge, because if we do a lot of business with these guys, they'll eventually become small-d democratic. And it just doesn't seem to work out that way.
That's always the argument and the rationalization, and we keep trying to avoid looking at how it really comes out.
And all these right-wing think tanks, the Hudson Institute, the Cato Institute, and so on, are all, you know, promoting this idea that economic liberalism will equal democratic liberty, and it just
yes, but
not
the
case.
I should say also, the Clinton administration also accepted that point of view.
Yeah, it's conventional wisdom. I think it's still being accepted by and large. James Mann, he's the author of The China Fantasy, a book you need to read, How Our Leaders Explain Away Chinese Repression. James, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. Yep, time to stand up. Thanks for listening to, by the way, to listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, supported by you, our listeners, listening for our sponsors on our local affiliates and letting them know that you're listening and patronizing their products, and our national sponsors as well, like SacredGroundsCoffee.com, All Organic, All Fair Trade, or Small Dog Electronics, SmallDog.com, The Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends at 866-380-MEOW. The New York Times, Antonia Juhas. Today, here's the article. Today, more than three-quarters of the world's oil is owned and controlled by governments. It wasn't always this way. Title of the article, Whose Oil Is It Anyway? Up until 35 years ago, the world's oil was largely in the hands of seven corporations based in the U.S. and Europe. They have now merged into four, Chevron, ExxonMobil, Shell, and BP. So Antonia Juhas is documenting this this transition that's happened over the last 35 years, how we've gone from a handful of very, very large private oil corporations owning most of the world's oil to nations owning the world's oil as they're increasingly asserting their right, their power, their ability to do this and saying, no, we're this is our oil. This is one of our resources. This is our national asset. Antonia Juhas then goes on to note, Iraq's oil reserves, thought to be the second largest in the world, have always been high on the corporate wish list. In 1998, Kenneth Darr, then chief executive of Chevron, and let's see, that would have been when Condi Rice was on the board of directors of Chevron, and there was a Chevron tanker floating around called the Condoleezza Rice, told a San Francisco audience, quote, Iraq possesses huge reserves of oil and gas, reserves I'd love Chevron to have access to. And, of course, it wasn't just Chevron that was salivating at the idea of all that Iraqi oil and gas.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, even Dick Cheney knew about this, right? So he convenes a task force, Dick Cheney's task force. He was given two jobs as vice president by George W. Bush. One, to put together a counterterrorism task force, because Sandy Berger and Al Gore and Bill Clinton on the way out said to respectively Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney and George Bush, Osama bin Laden is coming to get us. He's going to be your number one enemy. He's going to be the number one. You need to deal with this guy. We tried to get him. We tried to kill him. And we think he was responsible for the USS Cole. And it turned out about 2 weeks after George Bush became president, the CIA and FBI certified that Osama bin Laden was responsible for blowing up the USS Cole. George Bush said, we're not going to do anything about it. So Dick Cheney was put in charge of counterterrorism. That task force never met until September 2001. And he was put in charge of the Energy Task Force. They started meeting right away with big corporations, the big oil companies. And they came up with this plan for the privatization of the oil in Iraq. In fact, you know, one of the right-wing groups that sued Bill Clinton that led to the outing of the Monica Lewinsky case sued Dick Cheney and got the documents. Judicial Watch, judicialwatch.org, you can see it. The documents from March and April of 2001, long before 9/11, showing all of Iraq's oil fields all being divided up among, you know, different oil companies. And so they've got this new law that we're trying to push the Iraqi government to pass that will give these large multinational oil companies control over Iraq's oil, or will allow Iraq to sell its oil, to give its oil, essentially, to give its oil fields for 20 to 35 year periods to corporate interests. And in the New York Times, Antonia Juhas points out that none of the other companies, Iraq's neighbors, Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, maintain nationalized oil systems and have outlawed foreign control over oil development. But Iraq is fixing to do the exact opposite. Now, that's half the story. The other half of the story that is really bug-your-eyes-out mind-boggling comes from a piece by Heather Volkush, who's, you know, been on our program many times over the years, Crouching Tiger, Tumbling U.S. Economy. Just last year, Chinese oil company officials arrived in Baghdad to revive Hussein-era contracts for developing Iraq's oil, specifically contracts for the Adab oil field in south-central Iraq. Hundreds of millions of dollars and a reduction of Iraq's Chinese debt are already on the table. So we've invested 35,000 dead and wounded troops and $400 billion to make sure that Iraq can sell its oil to private corporations. And guess who's going to sign the first major contract? China. China. China similarly has contracts like this with Iran, and if we invade Iran and screw things all up, they'll come in after the fact and say, hey, you want to do business with us again? We've already got a contract, but just like they're fixing to do in Iraq. Sun Tzu once noted, there is no instance of a country having benefited from prolonged warfare. Well, you could argue that China will benefit from our prolonged warfare in Iraq. And they may if we do Iran as well. Amazing, huh? 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least clean elections. How about we fiendishly plot for U.S. attorneys who will actually prosecute vote fraud like happened in Florida or Ohio? See, I want to know about the U.S. attorneys who didn't get fired. The ones who are doing what Roe wanted and refusing to investigate actual crimes. The newest little drib of this coming out slowly, Patrick Fitzgerald, you know, the guy who prosecuted Scooter Libby, U.S. attorney. He's a U.S. attorney. And you say, oh, gee, you know, he prosecuted the vice president's right-hand guy. He must have been okay. It must be that the Bush administration was putting in U.S. attorneys that were actually decent people. Well, it turns out he was appointed over Karl Rove's objections. Former Senator, this from the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org. Former Senator Peter Fitzgerald, no relationship to Patrick Fitzgerald. This gets confusing. He was the senator from Illinois, the Republican senator from Illinois, revealed yesterday that in 2001, Karl Rove pressured him to choose a U.S. attorney who he believed would be lenient in probing state corruption. This is in the Chicago Tribune today. Peter Fitzgerald, the senator, the Republican senator, ends up choosing Patrick Fitzgerald, no relation. And now he said, the senator says he believes Rove was trying to influence the selection in reaction to pressure from Representative Dennis Hastert, then Speaker of the House, and allies of then-Governor George Ryan, who knew that the senator was seeking someone from outside Illinois to attack political corruption. Fitzgerald said, I'm sorry, that the U.S. attorney, you get these Fitzgeralds mixed up, you see this. He announced his choice on Mother's Day, a Sunday, to preempt any opposition. He says, a year or so later, Karl Rove, quote, said to me that Fitzgerald appointment got great headlines for you, but it ticked off the base. Who is the base? Illinois Republican insiders upset at the prosecutor's assault on corruption. Interesting. Let's take a real quick look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
These are security developments in Iraq as of today, 16:45 Greenwich Mean Time, from Reuters, Dateline Baghdad. Iraqi troops raided a complex in eastern Baghdad occupied by Palestinian refugees. When was the last time you heard that word in connection with Iraq? After receiving information that a car bomb was inside the compound, shooting broke out and three gunmen were killed, 25 others arrested, including Iraqis and Palestinians. In Fallujah, a U.S. Marine was killed in combat Tuesday in Anbar province. In Baqaba, police found four decapitated heads. It is not clear who the victims were. In Baghdad, gunmen killed Mudhar al-Ubadai, the head of Baghdad's Ahmadiyya municipality, and one of his guards. His son was wounded in the attack. Near Hilla, gunmen killed three off-duty policemen. In Tuz Camarto, a suicide bomber killed 10 people and wounded 15. In Mosul, several mortar rounds landed in a residential district, killing a man and his child and wounding four. In Baghdad, a car bomb exploded near an Iraqi army checkpoint, killing one person and wounding four. In Mosul, gunmen killed two policemen. In Kirkuk, gunmen killed one civilian in his store and kidnapped his brother. In Yerkuk, a motorist was killed when a roadside bomb blew up next to his vehicle. In Baghdad, the Iraqi army found 1,600 liters of nitric acid in 64 small containers prepared as roadside bombs. Near Fallujah, the bodies of two men were found with gunshot wounds and signs of torture. In Dawania, gunmen killed two police officers and wounded another. And in Iskandaria, a Sunni mosque was badly damaged on Tuesday when militants planted bombs inside it in that town 25 miles south of Baghdad. What a great war Mr. Bush brought us. 35,000 dead or wounded U.S. soldiers, as many as 600,000, maybe more, dead Iraqi civilians. God only knows how many are wounded. Over $400 billion of our tax money. So the Chinese can come in and sign the oil contracts. My mind is boggled. Is yours? This is absolutely incredible. Della in Manhattan. Hey, Della, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello, Tom. Tom, I agree with you on most things, but I do not agree with you about, though, the people's voice will be heard. It doesn't matter if we elect Hillary. You know, we don't know what they're going to do in the future, but we do know what they're going to do in the past, and we do know that when NAFTA was passed, two-thirds of the American population were opposed to it, and Congress was opposed to it. It was a Democratic Congress.
And the American people were not speaking out.
In order to pass it, passed around $7.5 billion of goodies to Congress in order to get that bill passed. So the voice of the people will not be heard, and we have to judge them on their record. And as far as our vote on the war, you know, we hear a lot about what I didn't find in Niger or in Africa, but we have not heard about an article that Bob Graham wrote, What I Knew Before the Invasion. He was chairman of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, and he wrote an article damning any of the evidence that they had found about weapons of mass destruction. And this was passed around to Congress.
Now we see, you know, Bob Shrum's autobiography in which he's saying that, you know, John Edwards voted for the war basically because Shrum told him he should, and it was the political thing, and John Edwards really didn't want to do it. And that was the conventional wisdom that the political advisors were giving. No, Della, I get your point. I absolutely get your point. And over the short term, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right that Clinton pushed through NAFTA and GATT with the complicity of big multinational corporations and a whole bunch of Republicans and Democrats as well, the DLC Democrats, over the opposition of the American people. But the American people were not speaking out loudly. If you look at every movement, every historic movement, whether it's the suffrage movement, whether it's the move to end slavery, whether it's the civil rights movement, whether it was the movement to end the Vietnam War, you don't necessarily see things change in a year or 6 months or 2 years. Sometimes it takes a generation. Sometimes it takes a century. But you do see change come about as a result of people becoming engaged. And so what's the alternative? To say, I'm not going to participate? I just don't consider that a viable alternative. We have to get engaged because it's the only method, it's the only technique, it's the only thing we have, really, in a democracy, to the extent that we still have a democracy, is our ability to engage it. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Hi. Hey, can you give me at least a minute to get my points out?
I don't know. It depends on, okay. Depends on how well you do with them. You usually do very well, Tom.
Okay, well, this is relevant.
But you're going to read something.
To your topic regarding autocratic China practicing laissez-faire and unfettered capitalism in their economic system. And I don't know whether you've made this connection, but back in 1962, the laissez-faire voodoo clown Milton Friedman published a book entitled Capitalism and Freedom.
Yes,
and those two, huh?
I know.
Yeah, those two words juxtaposed on the cover started this confusion of equating a system of governance with an economic system.
I would argue that it started back in the 50s in American pop culture with Ayn Rand.
Well, that ran with it with Friedman in his Newsweek column articles. And all
Friedman made it legitimate. He made it mainstream.
Then Kevin Phillips, 40 years later, took a play on those words and wrote the book Wealth and Democracy to prove that he was wrong. Nobody ever gets that. It was a play on words saying that it's democracy that creates wealth.
Sure.
So this dynamic tension between the two, and you brought up beautifully today with China and all that. But go ahead and play FDR's 36 Philly speech that talks about the economic royalists and this confusion between political system and economic system.
Yeah. We'll have to do it on another day because it takes me a minute to get
this. Just one more thing,
up,
Tom. Yeah. Am I still
on? Yes, sir, John. You still are.
Okay. Democracy's egalitarian principles of equal justice, equal rights, gender equality, race equality sounds too much like Karl Marx's use of the word equality, and that's what screws all these cons up, right? Because, oh, my God, it's equal and all that. This is where they confuse democracy, capitalism, and I'm telling you, this is the Rosetta Stone that cracks the code, and you're bringing it up beautifully by constantly showing this, I don't know what you call it, this...
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you, Tom, and I appreciate the call, and thank you for making your point. And hopefully, that was more than a minute. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, we only have 1 minute until we have to take a break. What's up?
Okay, this is easy. Every day I get asked by people, how can I get involved? What can I do? And recently came up with a real simple idea. You know, the thing is we need to communicate with our so-called representatives. And I recommend all of us program the phone numbers of Congress, Senate, and the House, especially local offices, in your cell phone, and every time you hear anyone complain, hand the phone to them and say, call the Congress right now.
That's a good idea.
And one thing is to do is just do that as a regular thing. Every day, get two friends to call and get them to pass that on.
Yeah.
And you'll find by the end of the week, you will have caused hundreds of people to call Congress.
You know, you can get 500 business cards printed up for about $15 these days. And if you had business cards printed up that simply gave the name and phone number of the elected officials in your district, federal and state, and you could pass those out and say, okay, here's your two U.S. senators, here's your member of the House of Representatives in this zip code, you know, where we live, here is your state senator, here is your state member of the House of Representatives, here's the governor's office, here's the president, here's the number for the White House. Call them and
exactly.
Just hand them that card. Yeah, great plan. Thank you, Jeff. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the radio support group of by and for we the people of the United States of America. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Doug in Staten Island. You're live and on the air, Doug.
Hi, how are you this afternoon?
I'm just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
There you go. Listen, you know, China is just practicing basically rampantly in the open what we do under the guise of democracy. I mean, they have 674 countries involved in 40 companies involved in 49 countries. Their trade is up 300%. Their oil, they get a quarter. They take a quarter of Angola's oil. They take 60% of Sudan's exports, et cetera. They have stakes in Equatorial Guinea, Nigeria, Gabon, and so on.
They're becoming the next empire.
Absolutely. And, you know, I remember seeing the tape from the 2004 General Electric hearing where you have Jeffrey Immitt saying, quote, when I'm talking to GE managers, I talk China, 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 China. You need to be there. I'm a nut on China. Outsourcing from China is going to grow $5 billion a year. We are building a tech center in China. Every discussion today has to center on China. Now, here's a classic example, Tom. I live in Staten Island. We have something called the China Express. It's 9 ships that come here every week. Let me give you a classic example of what transpired recently. You had 1,120 cartons, containers, taken off. They contained leather goods, merchandise, furniture, clothing, and so on. We shipped back 667 cartons. 419 of them were empty. The other ones were filled with scrap metal and scrap paper. We ship out cotton. They ship back clothes. We ship out leather goods. They ship back leather goods. We ship out scrap metal. They ship back.
Yeah, you're saying the same thing that I say day after day, Doug. When Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981, We were the largest exporter of finished goods in the world and the largest importer of raw materials. We were the definition of a fully industrialized first world country. 26 years of conservative economics and insane international trade policies later, we are now the world's largest importer of finished goods and the world's largest exporter of raw materials.
We're simply a page holder right now, Tom.
We're a third world country.
We're a page holder for the for China and for India's rising middle class. I think it was Jefferson said, the selfish spirit of commerce knows no country and feels no passion or principle but that of gain. It's really that simple. And by the way, FDR, I think what the gentleman was talking about before, I remember FDR said in 38, he said, the liberty of democracy is not safe if we tolerate the growth of private power to the point that it is stronger than the democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, well said, Doug. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Jeff, and spot on. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff.
Tom, thanks for taking the call. I got an urgent action alert for anybody who's ever been to a protest before or who has been and wants to be a part of something. This Saturday is the fourth anniversary of the start of the Iraq War, and there are protests going on all over the world. You can find out more at afterdowningstreet.org. And also here in Tacoma, particularly, we've got a huge coalition of, you know, a lot of mainstream groups. Even our local progressive talk station is sponsoring it. We hope to get a couple thousand. But anybody who lives in or near Tacoma, I'd love to see them there Saturday morning in Tacoma at 11 o'clock at People's Park. And then we're going to march down to Wright Park at 1:30 for a big rally.
Great. Jeff, thank you very much for pointing that out. And, yeah, this weekend is the anniversary and one that we can't just let pass. Ken in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Ken.
Yes, hey. You know, this U.S. attorney business, I think that there's one thing that everybody may be overlooking. I've heard rumblings that the anti-Clinton machine in Arkansas was starting up again, even before all this broke, in anticipation of Hillary being the nominee.
And sure, the people, of course.
And I think that it's no accident that Karl Rove had his friend put in as U.S. attorney in Arkansas, because I think the plan was for him to give legal legitimacy and underpinning and support to this anti-Clinton machine with all the stuff that they generated.
I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, I said that on the air when it first came out that was what was going on. That when it first came out that this was Rove's assistant who had been put in that place, was that if they don't control Congress, so they can't do congressional investigations into the Clintons like they were doing when Bill was president, where you've got, you know, now it's first it's Watergate and then it's Whitewater Gate and then it's Travel Gate and then it's Vince Foster Gate and then it's, I mean, you know, they went through so many different Rose Law Firm Gate. I mean, you know, if they don't have the power of Congress to do that, then let's get a friendly federal attorney down there. He ought to be able to do that.
Would it be possible to find out what his agenda? Maybe had he already gotten some marching orders?
I have a feeling Congress is going to find that out, Ken. They're not going to let this thing slide by. There is blood in the water, and the sharks are circling. Thanks for the call, though. Dan in Eugene, Oregon. We have about a minute. Dan, what's up?
Yeah, well, in regards to Halliburton, I would suggest that all the listeners call their representatives and have them freeze their assets and yank their passports.
But you can't do that. I mean, let me differentiate. I mean, this is why, you know, people say, oh, you know, Walmart is terrible. And I say, yeah, I don't like their business practices and I don't shop there. But it's not, Walmart's not the problem. And Halliburton is not the problem. The problem is that we have rules, you know, laws, the rules of the game of business set in place that allow Halliburton to do what they're preparing to do, that allow Walmart to do what they're preparing to do. And if we don't change the structural stuff, if we don't change the laws, then it's just going to be some other company doing it next week.
Exactly.
So it's not about Halliburton being evil or bad. They're simply doing what's legal, what's possible. What we need to do is change our laws so that those things are not legal.
Exactly.
Does that make sense?
But isn't there a question of do they have some of the money that's gone missing?
Oh, yeah. Well, it may well be. I mean, yeah, certainly. If they have ripped off the American taxpayer, we need to find out. And if there's been fraud, we need to find out in the investigations. And if they're trying to move offshore to avoid those investigations, they should be nailed for it. If they, you know, crimes have been committed. But I'm far more concerned, frankly, with the larger structural stuff, because that's going to last for generations. Coming up tomorrow, conservative Yaron Brook and I debating FCC and freedom of speech. Lawrence O'Donnell from Huffington Post. Mark Crispin Miller telling us about the theft of our vote once again. tragic news on the Tom Hartman program. And remember, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.